Welcome. Rob Hollister is with us today. He's a professor of economics at Swarthmore College and one of the nation's experts in social policy and program evaluation. Over his career, he's helped advance our knowledge of what works and what's cost-effective in policy areas such as job training, employment services, welfare reform, education, and community development. In 2006, he won the Peter Rossi Award, given by the Public Policy Association, APAM, for his contributions to the field of program evaluation. Rob, welcome to you. It is great to have an important mentor of mine since college on the blog.
Well, Andy, thank you for, through all the years we've worked together on these kinds of issues, and you've got a great career underway, and I hope this in some ways doesn't shoot it down.
So, Rob, if we're going to start on a lighthearted note, before we wade into some more fundamental evaluation topics, you've been playing jazz piano lately. Any lessons from jazz for those of us who are interested in program evaluation?
From jazz? Yeah, well, the thing is, unfortunately, in this case, improvisation does not enrich the study.
So, Rob, one of the stories I'd like for you to share with our listeners is from the supported work demonstration in the 1970s, which was an employment program at 15 sites around the nation. And it's a story of one of the first realizations in social policy in which impact evaluation using random assignment produced results that were unexpected and that underscored the value of rigorous evaluation for our learning about what works. Tell us about that story.
One of the sites was in Philadelphia in the Kensington area, the poor area, northeastern Philadelphia. And the target group that they were dealing with were youth. So during the operation of the whole experiment, the operating company was the then called the Manpower Development Research Corporation. So they were continually looking at how were these projects operating. And about halfway through, they concluded that the Philadelphia site was such a mess that there's no way there could be any positive effect from this. And they were going to shut it down. But we convinced them, no, don't do that. Don't shut it down. Let's let it go to the end and see what happens. Then when we went and did the analysis amongst the sites serving youth, the Philadelphia site was the most effective and had significant positive effects in terms of their post-program employment.
It was one of the early lessons that having a rigorous evaluation design was really important.
Right.
So insights like those and many others helped change the evaluation field over the past several decades. Is that fair to say?
Over the years, it's evolved a lot with increasing demand for rigor in the evaluation. But in the early stage, an expert would fly in and look at what was going on and pronounce this is a success or not a success. And yeah. It was really only at the end of the 1960s that we began to get in much more rigorous evaluation. There had already been some evaluation movement before that, but no real emphasis on rigor.
One of the terms that's closely connected to the concept of rigor, rigorous evaluation, is the term counterfactual.
Right.
And for policy officials or program managers who are strengthening their knowledge about program evaluation, how do you describe what that term means?
Well, the simplest term to apply to this is we want to know what would have happened to these individuals of this type in this group, had they not been afforded the opportunity that what we call the treatment, the program, whatever it is, be it a new reading program or a skills training program, what would have happened to them in terms of the outcomes that we're measuring from this, so employment or scores on a test, on a reading test, and so forth, had they not had the treatment. So in an idealized thing, you'd like to take the same people, you know, and have, say, mm-hmm. Well, this person, I gave them the treatment, this is what happened. Now I didn't give them the treatment, that's what happened. But that you can't do, and it won't give you the right answer anyway, because either they have the treatment or they don't have it at some point.
Yeah.
So what we do is to try to create a group that will be equivalent in characteristics that possibly relate to the outcome to the group that actually is assigned to get the treatment or the program. So the important thing, as we'll talk about, is that random assignment, just by the process of random assignment, when you get to a reasonable sample size, assures that the characteristics of the treatment group on average and the control group created by the random assignment on average are the same. You've removed really any differences from factors other than the treatment that would cause the outcome to be different between these two groups. Yeah.
So I'd like to give folks another example of this so we can flesh it out a little bit. Let's say that you're trying to estimate the impact of a program, or maybe it's different strategies within a program so that you know what works best. Let's say to do that, you create a comparison group. And maybe you go out in the community and you find a set of people that look very similar. Maybe pick people with the same education levels.
Right.
And that's called creating a matched comparison group.
Yes.
The challenge, as you pointed out, is that there are observable characteristics that you can do that matching on, like education levels, but there are also unobservable ones.
Right.
Like the motivation level of people. And it's those unobservable characteristics that make it hard to do that matching. So you've been one of the leading voices, Rob, in arguing that the power of random assignment, when you can do it, when it's feasible, is that you don't need to go out and try to create a valid comparison group, which can be challenging.
So this evolved in social sciences, really, starting in the late 1960s when we started the first big social experiment, the negative income tax experiment in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And when we did random assignment, we dealt with that problem entirely because you've equalized the two groups in terms of both characteristics which you might be able to measure or have measured and those which you can't measure that might affect the outcome. So you're really, now there was a literature that was developing through the 1960s, continues on to this day, with people trying to create comparison groups, doing different kinds of matching. So in the 1990s, we began to do a group of studies where we could test the most sophisticated of these matching methods and see, by testing it using data from the experiment and then creating a comparison group, and it's important, I always like to say, don't say control group unless it was created by random assignment, call it a comparison group. So we, a number of us, at about the same time, we're all working on this, using different kinds of experimental data sets, and taking the treatment group and then creating a comparison group, in particular in the later studies, better studies, using the control group people in the experiment, but reassigning them according to supposedly matching people in the treatment group on the characteristics that you'd measured. So there's number one. You're only going to be able to measure on observed or observable characteristics. So the most recent one that's in great favor is called propensity score matching. It's a very complex process of finding matching individuals. And we tested this, about five of us did studies with different data sets to see how close would the comparison group match come to the actual experimental estimates. And the general conclusion was not very close at all. And that was the most sophisticated method of matching. So from my point of view, you're not going to get reliable estimates of the impact of a given intervention using comparison groups because there is this problem of the unobservables.
So one question that people, I think, often have in thinking about impact evaluation with random assignment is, what are the ethical criteria that we should be using to think about whether that approach is justified or not? Because you do have a program group that gets certain services, but you also have a control group that doesn't. So, Rob, what are some of the criteria that may be helpful in making that kind of decision?
The first one is that you only want to do an experiment if you truly are uncertain about the effect. There's some reasonably high degree of uncertainty about, will the effect be positive in the direction that you want it to be on the outcomes of interest, or will it be nothing, no effect, or will it in some case actually make things worse? So you have to have that degree of uncertainty, or there's, if you're really certain, or you have adequate experience elsewhere somehow, that the treatment is going to go in a particular direction with a particular magnitude. If you don't have that uncertainty, then you can't really justify the expenditure and the difficulty in doing the experiment.
As an example, people, we're talking about evaluation in social policy,
yeah.
But it's easy to, maybe easier to think about it as a drug trial. If you really knew a drug saved lives or hurt people, you can't justify using it.
Right.
The equivalent in social policy is if you knew a program really helped, that's not a legitimate unknown.
Right.
Yeah.
The second thing, which is critical for having a random assignment study, is that you don't have the resources to make the treatment available to anyone who might want to have it or seem to benefit to somebody. Or at least you don't have the resources in the absence of good evidence that it's important. Once that shortage occurs, then you can do random assignment perfectly ethically. You say, well, they got a shot at it that they wouldn't have had at all before. And that's opposed to when we talk to program operators and they say, oh, look, I know this person really needs this and will benefit from it. But you know, you say, well, we don't have enough to do everybody. And so this is fairer than what you're doing. You're imposing your judgment as to who will most benefit from this study. And here we're saying everybody gets an equal chance to get it. And we're going to find out who most benefits from this.
If you can't serve everyone, then you're in a situation where a lottery may be the fairest way to actually decide who gets the services.
Right.
If you're going to do a lottery anyway, that sets you up perfectly for a randomized controlled trial. Rob, I know that you've never been a proponent that the perfect has to be the enemy of the good here, and that, in other words, we should do the most rigorous evaluation method that we can given the circumstances. However, you have this quote, which I wanted to share with our listeners, which is, randomized control trials, in other words, impact evaluation using random assignment, is like, quote, the nectar of the gods. Once you've had a taste of the pure stuff, it's hard to settle for the flawed alternatives, unquote. Tell us about what you mean by that.
Well, the thing is that the random assignment does so many things. It is relatively straightforward and simple to understand compared to when we construct through some elaborate method this comparison group. So that's always a virtue. The other main virtue is it controls for all these potential unobserved factors that could affect the outcome. Now, this is important not just in the initial stages of the thing, but all of these studies roll out over time. And the surrounding conditions that can affect the outcome are changing all the time. If you're trying to model this by taking measurement of the unemployment rate in Detroit and measurement of the unemployment rate in Miami and sort of use the unemployment rate to adjust the, you know, make the results be in some sense equivalent, you don't really know what it is. But when you've got random assignment, you've got control groups in both areas, whatever's happening there that could affect the outcome is happening to both groups in the same way. So these are unobservables that are changing over time. And that's really a big, big advantage.
I want to end, Rob, by asking you to give some historical perspective. Randomized control trials were seen with a very wary eye many decades ago in social policy, public policy. Today, there's much more of an assumption that it's the gold standard. Talk about that transition more as you've seen it.
Yeah, it's now, I was just at a conference a couple of weeks ago on poverty and inequality, and every person presenting a paper started off by saying, now, to study this phenomenon, whatever it was, we really should have a randomized control trial. Everybody understands that's the gold standard, but some of them could have that. But for these, some of these things, there's something that precludes our ability to have it. So we're going to try to do the best we can with secondary methods. So I'm just astounded because starting from where we started, and as I said, with the negative income tax experiment in New Jersey at the end of the 1960s, we had a period where there was a flurry of experiments after that in a number of fields, the most famous one being the health insurance study that started in the mid-1970s.
and went on for a while and is still extremely widely quoted in the healthcare reform debate and so forth. But then there was kind of a fallow period, and I remember Judy Garon and I discussing this in 1985. There was almost nothing going on with randomized control trials at that point in time. Then with welfare reform, you began to get, and MDRC was sort of a leader in this, but everybody else got in on the act, Mathematica, APT, and so forth. They were all doing experiments to try to look at various dimensions of welfare reform. So I think that was a very important process. In terms of the wider world, what happened was somebody, and particularly Esther Duflo, I guess, at Harvard, finally got the international organizations to agree that they should do random assignment for studies. And I had talked to the World Bank in 1975 saying, look, you guys are the perfect people to do these experiments because, of course, there's always a shortage of resources. And so doing a lottery is obviously a way to allocate those resources, and you can really learn from that process. But I couldn't get anywhere there. They weren't interested in, is the study rigorous enough for us to act on it?
Rob, thanks very much for sharing your insights. It's great to have you on the blog.